we all carry these assumptions and prejudices and biases, and that most of them are unconscious. We're not aware of the biases that we're carrying, and yet these are effectively responses to the people around us. And they have an enormous impact on our ability to work together effectively. And if we're being driven by our unconscious, which neuroscientists these days would say is 90% or more of our mental activity is unconscious, that gives rise to some interesting questions about what can we do to work together more effectively. So we need to know who it is that we're working with and what are our preferences for who we like to work with, who challenges us. And given that we don't always get to choose who we work with, how do we work more effectively with the people who are different to us in some way?
So you're a smart business committed to innovation, to service, and to modern marketing. And you're asking, what's next? Wondering how you can become even more innovative. My name is Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and this is the InnovaBuzz podcast, where we share all kinds of tips, advice, and interview guests on all things innovation and leadership in modern marketing. Hi there, innovator. It's great to be back with another episode. I hope you've had an awesome week so far. I also hope that you enjoyed our most recent interviews with Adam Ashton of the What You Will Learn podcast and with Jonathan Grzybowski of Penji. I'm really excited today to have as my guest on the InnovaBuzz podcast from just near me in Melbourne, Australia, Duncan Smith, who's an organisational consultant and one of the leading practitioners in the area of diversity and inclusion. Duncan's core business is helping leaders work more effectively and make better decisions, helping business leaders increase their capacity to build trust, to hold open and honest conversations, to make more inclusive decisions, and to build high-functioning teams using the power of diversity to solve problems, and also building stronger working relationships across lines of difference. Duncan has worked in 24 countries on four continents throughout the world, and now through ADC Associates, his company works with a global network of diversity and inclusion practitioners in 19 countries. So he definitely is exposed to lots of different cultures and environments. On his website, Duncan states succinctly that he helps people work together better. Today's episode is brought to you by the Transformational Marketing Hub, where you'll find a host of free and exceptionally useful information to help you transform your marketing. You can access the Transformational Marketing Hub by visiting innovabiz.co/VIP. So go check it out. It's free to join, and if you're a member already, just log in to get your resources. In our discussion today, Duncan talked to me about the five foundations of diversity and why diversity is important. He talked to me about how a focus on self-awareness of your own culture, of your own situation, or your own privilege can help you embrace diversity. And he outlined his why, who, how framework for diversity and how it applies to innovation. Without further ado, then, let's fly into the hive and get the buzz from Duncan Smith. Hi, I'm your host, Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm really excited to welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast today, all the way from the other side of Melbourne, Australia, in a beautiful little town in the Dandenong Ranges, Duncan Smith, who's an organizational consultant and one of the leading practitioners in the area of diversity and inclusion. Welcome to the podcast, Duncan. It's a great privilege to have you as my guest.
Thank you, Jürgen. It's good to be with you.
Dr. Tom Vergus, who was our guest on episode 176 of the InnovaBuzz podcast, suggested that we interview you, Duncan. So big hello to Tom. Now, on your website, You state that you help people work together better. Now, I love how simple and clear that is, and yet diversity and culture and getting people to work together can be, not so simple. So I'm really looking forward to exploring those topics a lot more today and getting some insights from you. But before we start talking about all things diversity and leadership and high-functioning teams, I'm interested a little bit more about your background. It turns out in our pre-conversation that you actually lived in a little town in Germany very close to where I was living, and it might well have been at the same time. We didn't explore the timeline. But give us a bit of background to how you got to where you are today and what some of the pivotal moments in that journey were.
Well, it's interesting looking back on my work history and life history, thinking about the work that I do now. It all makes sense in hindsight. At the time, it wasn't necessarily obvious. But so I did a bachelor's degree in comparative religion, which focused a lot on Asian religion and culture. So basically, I was brought up in a, not hugely religious household, but in a Christian cultural tradition. So I was interested in what other traditions had to say, and how they made sense of the world. So looked a lot at Hinduism, Islam, Judaism, Buddhism. And as part of that study, of course, you have to study the cultural context that these religions come out of. I then got my first job out of what Americans call college or university, working for an American company in Europe, which is what took me to Germany. So I had the opportunity to work all over Europe and really see different cultures in action and how they differed and how people interacted between cultures, cultural assumptions, certainly coming out of United States culture, what were some of the assumptions that were different from the cultures I was working in. I eventually went back to the U.S. and got involved in looking at how technology, in particular media, were used in communication, sales, and marketing, got into audiovisual production, wound up running a computer education center at the Museum of Science in Boston, which is where I'm from originally, and then wound up at a large technology company, Digital Equipment Corporation, which at the time, Digital and IBM were the two big computer companies in the world. Digital no longer exists. Obviously, IBM does, but Digital eventually got merged with and taken over by Compaq, which eventually got taken over by Hewlett-Packard. But while I was at Digital, I was in an internal leadership development program. And I also went back to school and did a master's in education, looking at organizational behavior and adult learning. And it was a program where I got to study with people from, this was at Harvard, I got to study with people from Harvard Business School, from the law school and negotiations, from the medical school and cross-racial counseling. It was a really design-your-own program. So all of these things came together, and at that time, I went through a two-day program at Digital, the company I was at, on diversity and inclusion. Just went through it as an employee, and I just had one of those light bulb moments that here are ways of understanding and talking about the dynamics between people in the workplace that have a big impact on how well people are able to work together. And that really got me started on this path that I'm on now. I came out to Australia, sort of did a kind of a self-funded sabbatical after finishing my my master's degree, and backpacked around New Zealand, Australia, Indonesia, Malaysia, Singapore, Thailand, back to Australia, and decided to see what Australia would be like for a year or so before I settled back in Boston for the rest of my life. And that year has magically turned into 27 years. So, and I guess along the way, as I've wanted to distill, what is it that I'm most interested in? It's not diversity for its own sake, but it is, as you said at the beginning, how do we work together effectively as teams, as organizations, as leadership teams? Diversity is a part of that. But there's a broader picture there in how do we bring people together to solve problems and to to make progress with some of the issues that are facing both organizations and the world at large. So that's where I focus.
Yeah, well, that's a really fascinating journey. And you're right. You know, we tend to look back on our experiences. And if you kind of plot a path backwards, it often looks like it was really strategic and well planned. And it was quite the opposite at the time. But I'm fascinated coming out of that area of religious study and comparative religious study, I think you called it. That sounds like something that should be compulsory education for everybody in today's world. That's fascinating.
Well, it is fascinating, and it's the sort of thing at the time, classic American-style liberal arts education, not designed for a specific career. So I didn't have any intentions of going into any sort of religious profession, but it was just an interesting thing to look at. And of course, now religion is fairly topical in a lot of ways. But the thing that it helped me to understand is, and in fact, this is what I focused on in my thesis for that degree, was that I draw a clear distinction between religion and spirituality. That religions are really cultural and political and social constructs that act accordingly. They may or may not have anything to do with the underlying spiritual tradition. And this is why you see actions being kind of perpetrated in the name of religions that really are completely counter to what the religions in fact say. So it's important to understand religion as a political and social construct, I think.
That's a really good point. I guess where I was coming from was, and we'll get on to diversity in a moment, is around understanding people's belief systems and particularly where those belief systems are perhaps quite different to your own belief systems and understanding why people might have different beliefs and why and how that drives them. And being, getting to a point of saying, we can all live together and in peace and harmony. It's not a conflict trigger. It shouldn't be a conflict trigger.
Well, you would think so, but we get into the belief systems and then what are the underlying values that people hold and how are those expressed in behaviors? And it's quite interesting to look at, particularly with Islam, for example, if you look at a country like Saudi Arabia, which is, of course, Islamic dominated, look at a country like Malaysia, and they're completely different expressions of what theoretically is the same religion. So there are some commonalities there, but then how they're expressed in terms of people's values and behaviors has more to do with culture in a way. So it's fascinating. The more you dig into some of these questions, the more complexity you find.
Yeah. Well, like I said at the beginning, I like how you really simplified what you do in those words, but it kind of hides in a way how complex the whole topic is. Now, you have four words on the website where you focus on helping people work together in their leadership, culture, diversity, and inclusion. And I wanted to start with diversity and get you to tell us what you understand by that. And why is it important? I guess it's a double-headed question.
Sure. So when I think about people working together better and helping people work together, there are a couple of elements to it. One is the how do people work together, and that relates to culture piece. So which could be national culture or culture of teams or groups or organizations. There's the leadership piece, which we can come to, but then there's the who is it that's actually working together. And what I found early on in first coming across this work around diversity is that we all carry deeply held assumptions, prejudices. Prejudice meaning prejudgment. It's often seen as a negative term, but it's an activity that we all do. And biases, again, I like to use bias as a neutral term or in an engineering sense, that you can be biased towards something or away from something. It can be positive or negative. It's simply a preference. And so we all carry these assumptions and prejudices and biases, and that most of them are unconscious. We're not aware of the biases that we're carrying, and yet these are effectively responses to the people around us, and they have an enormous impact on our ability to work together effectively. And if we're being driven by our unconscious, which neuroscientists these days would say is 90% or more of our mental activity is unconscious, that gives rise to some interesting questions about what can we do to work together more effectively? So we need to know who it is that we're working with and what are our preferences for who we like to work with, who challenges us. And given that we don't always get to choose who we work with, how do we work more effectively with the people who are different to us in some way? So there's this fundamental idea that there are what I call five foundations of diversity. I brought a book on this out last year. And the first one is simply noticing who is like me and who is not like me, similarity and difference. And that can cover a whole range of areas, but it's that first step of, and we're very good at noticing who's similar and who's different and looking for commonalities. We're actually hardwired to look for similarity and to respond to that positively. And hardwired to respond to difference is more challenging to us, basically.
And so, on that though, I mean, it's interesting you say we're hardwired to look for similarity, and yet it seems to me that most people seem to focus on difference. So they kind of walk around and they say, "Well, there's a person that's different to me," and they stand out in their, you know, unconsciously they stand out to them. So they kind of look up and perk up, whereas if people who are similar to them, unless they're close friends or somebody there's a close friend, that will perk their interest. But just sort of the run-of-the-mill same person is kind of filtered out in the noise of the day-to-day information that comes in.
You're exactly right. And we notice difference more easily. And one of the things that noticing is about is that it triggers the limbic system, the very old part of the brain that contains the fight, flight, or freeze response. Yeah. And so we're constantly looking and noticing to see, okay, is this person, okay, I'm noticing a difference. And it, you know, just goes back to the prehistoric days where here's somebody coming across the savannah. Are they going to, you know, steal my mastodon, you know, kill, or are they friendly? And I've got to be able to work that out very quickly. So there's this response that difference is potentially dangerous. And again, it happens very, very quickly, I mean, almost instantaneously, and at a very deep level in the mind. So we're almost pre-programmed to think that difference is potentially dangerous, and so we have that heightened awareness, as you mentioned.
All right, and you were going on to talk about the other four points or the other four elements of the diversity,
right? So let's say, okay. We want to work with diversity. And the first step is, again, to define, well, what do we mean by that? So if we're looking at some particular aspect of you know, similarity and difference, or us and them, as I sometimes describe it, step one is to say, well, what do we want to work with? And depending on what country you're in, topical areas tend to vary. So in Australia, for example, in the private sector, if you say diversity, most people think gender, which is actually code for women. We can come back to that. If you go to the U.S., I was just presenting at a conference in the U.S., the Forum on Workplace Inclusion. If you say diversity, the thing that comes up first is race. And what's interesting, come back to Australia, white Australians particularly tend not to use the word race. They tend to use the word culture instead of race. And so context makes a big difference. But anyway, so let's decide we're going to work with a particular aspect of diversity. And let's pick gender as an example. So, okay, gender, I say it's code for women, but actually both men and women have gender. And so to me, it's important to look at it systemically. And that goes to the second point, which is majority and minority, and being able to place ourselves in terms of a particular situation. Let's say we're at a technology company and tech companies tend to be male dominated, and without putting a value judgment on it, to say, okay, well, do we have a majority of men and a minority of women? And where am I in that pattern? And so what does that tell me about my experience? Because we know that the majority and minority experiences of the same situation are quite different. And so being able to understand our own perspective and how that allows us to see the situation and to experience it, and to know that, you know, if I'm a man, as I am, I don't know what it's like to be a woman in a male-dominated environment. So if it's important for me to work with that area, then I need to find out what is the female experience in a male-dominated environment. Could be the other way around. If it's nursing, it's majority women, minority men. It's the same sort of dynamic, but it's being able to understand it. So then the third point is to look at the assumptions and biases. So what assumptions do we make about people on the basis of gender? We know that, for example, there's a lot of study being done that suggests that we tend to look more for warmth and relational and cooperative behaviors in women, and more for assertive and competitive type behaviors in men. And so when we look for those behaviors in whatever gender we're looking for, that's what we tend to see more easily. So it's called confirmation bias. So we have an assumption that, oh, this is what women are like, this is what men are like, and so then that's what we look for. So unpacking the assumptions and biases is the third point. The fourth point
there's a fair bit of self-awareness there that is required in that, isn't there? Because you, as you say, it's very hard for us as men to really understand what it might be like for a woman in a male-dominated environment, or vice versa. If we're in a situation where we're in the minority, it's hard for us to imagine how the majority of the female gender then, you know, how they're experiencing that environment. But to be self-aware of our own experience of it, and appreciating that there is a different experience of it, and also really digging down into those assumptions and bias that come out of our own experience, and questioning those, I suppose, in some ways, because often it's a case of, like you say, the women will behave this way, the men will behave that way, is kind of a rule and an assumption. And when that's not the case, then it kind of shakes our foundation as well.
You're absolutely right. And I often like to say that people will tend to think that diversity is about those other people who are different. But in fact, two things. One, diversity is about all of us. Just by definition, in any number of people, there is going to be some level of difference, even if it's just two people. And so the place that we need to start is with ourselves, to understand who am I, what's my perspective. And I do this with any aspect of diversity, particularly with cultural diversity. Often we think, oh, we need to learn about those other cultures who are different. We actually need to start with our own culture to understand the perspective we're coming from. So once we've done all that, then we get to the fourth piece, which is around inclusion and exclusion. Because based on those understandings of, you know, who's like me, who's not like me, what's the majority and minority, what are the assumptions and the biases, there's going to be a level at which some people are included more naturally and some people are excluded more. And again, often those dynamics go unexamined and remain unconscious. So trying to understand, well, who's included, who's excluded, how does that work, and how do you create a more inclusive culture? And that leads to the last of these five foundations, which is around power and privilege. So who has power? How is that expressed? And then the privilege piece is the automatic privilege that comes often with being part of the majority, and how does that get expressed? And I think the important piece with privilege, because it's a word that sparks a certain amount of response from people, particularly in the majority. If you start talking about male privilege or white privilege, there's a certain amount of resistance to that. It's the difference between structural privilege and an individual sense of privilege, which are very different. So as an example, I can, in Australia, which is a white majority country, I can walk into a corner store and maybe be treated, the person behind the counter responds to me in a very negative and angry way. My automatic response is like, boy, they're having a bad day. What's their problem? If I'm white, I'm not thinking that it has anything to do with my skin color. If I'm a person of a different skin color, minority skin color, and I walk in and the same thing happens, then, I don't know. Is it because this person is racist? Is it because they're having a bad day? And so it's a much more complex equation that I have to deal with. So if I'm white in that situation, I have automatic privilege. I don't have to think about my skin color because I'm in the majority. So again, that's structural privilege. It's not a sense of I'm walking around feeling privileged all the time. So those
and that comes, five areas. Comes back a little bit to the assumptions that you talked about earlier, yes. Doesn't it? Because there's a behavior and we then have a choice of how we respond to it, and we kind of respond to it depending on the meaning we associate to that behavior, which is an assumption.
Correct. So then, it comes back to, with all these five foundations, there's something that comes before them, which is, why would we look at this in the first place? And that's where I come back to helping people to work together better and more effectively. And so what I learned getting involved in the diversity and inclusion, or as it's now often called, diversity, equity, and inclusion area, was that it's something that enables people to work together better if you understand it and you're able to work with it. And there's an analogy here that I'll draw with having done work with some of the large resources companies, oil and gas or mining. The analogy is with safety, which might not seem obvious, but those companies start every meeting at whatever level you're at. The first item on the agenda is a safety topic. So, it's like, who's got a safety topic? And they don't know what's going to come up, but it's just that's the way every meeting starts. And I've asked people and executives in those organizations why they do it. And the reason is to shift the mindset so that people are constantly thinking about safety. And it used to be, as they would say in the old days, people got killed on the job. It's, tough business. That's just the way it goes. Now, of course, they're a lot more conscious of trying to put safety practices in place and have them happen on an ongoing basis. So safety is not their core business. It's an enabler of them functioning well. And in the same way, diversity, equity, and inclusion are not the core business of any of the organizations I work with, but understanding it and being able to work with it effectively helps them to deliver on what they're there to do.
Yeah, that's a really great point. I guess there's a bunch of things going on in the world today that make it that much more important. I mean, the first one you talked about, gender, and of course, the role of women in most societies has undergone quite dramatic change in the last 100-150 years, and today women are quite keen in general. This is a very big generalization on my part, but they're quite keen to get out into the workforce, to contribute to society, to start businesses, which they were kind of prevented from doing even up maybe 20, 30 years ago. And so there's a much more gender diversity out in the workforce and in business. At the same time, there's huge migration going on right throughout the world. So you have diversity of cultures and races and religions coming together in the general workplace as well. And the third one that I think is a big influence is the globalization. I mean, it's so easy for us to get onto the internet and talk to people all around the world, like I do on this podcast. It's easy for us to work together with people all around the world, either by hopping on an aircraft and traveling somewhere much faster than we could 20, 30 years ago, and also through the internet. So there's all these things coming into play where we're dealing with people that are diverse in so many different ways. So that's why it really is important. And, you know, the exciting thing about that is that we have this enormous potential of human capital that is now in that melting pot, isn't it?
Absolutely right. And it's interesting that what we're seeing politically to some extent is in a way a sort of a backlash, I think, on many areas, but particularly to globalization. I'm an unapologetic globalist, I believe. You know, we've got one planet that we share, and we need to figure out how to work together. Yet, you see this current rise of nationalism, which my hope is that we'll look back on it and say, "Well, that was just a blip. It was a reaction to people being afraid of change or moving too quickly." And of course, you know, understanding that. In terms of your podcast, you look a lot at innovation, and you know, we're looking at some of the innovation that's happening, some of the future trends. I'm involved in a global project that's looking at connecting diversity, equity, and inclusion and futures work. So how do we make sure that we're having a diversity, equity, and inclusion mindset as we look at things like synthetic biology and artificial intelligence and some of the other trends that are happening in the world. And I think to some extent it's natural that there's a resistance to change, and you know, maybe for some people globalization was moving too quickly, but I like to think that we'll get over this resistance and continue with this kind of global interconnectedness which we have, as you described.
Now, you've worked in, I think, 24 countries on four continents, and through ADC Associates, your company, you've got a network in 19 different countries. So I'm curious about some of the challenges you've encountered working across those countries and with people in different cultures and backgrounds.
Some of the challenges. Well, look, I think the biggest challenge that I find is that, like everyone else, I have my own cultural programming, the things that make sense to me. And when you spoke to Tom Virgus, he may have talked about this idea of cultural programming and, you know, the things that we're brought up just understanding this is how the world works. And the biggest challenge is then to understand what's my cultural programming, and so how am I responding to different situations, and can I be open to the fact that other people see the world very differently? So 3 weeks ago, I was working in India, then 2 weeks ago, I was back in Australia, and last week I was in the US. And so each one of those cultures are quite different. And so the challenge is being able to stay, I think, open and curious, and also to be willing to, allow yourself to make mistakes and not always get it right, but then to have the capacity to reflect on, oh, what's happening here, and to be able to engage with people in other cultures to understand more how they're coming at things. What's interesting is that for any of us, we have our cultural programming, and often we don't know what it is until we come up against another culture. So just because someone is from another culture doesn't necessarily mean they have the capacity to understand, or that they consciously understand what their own cultural programming is. I'll give you a funny example of that, which actually happened in the U.S. a number of years ago, when I was at a diversity conference and in a session where we were looking at race issues. And we were paired up with other people in the workshop, and of someone from a different race. So I was working with an African-American woman who's actually from the Army in uniform. And her first question to me was, "So, Duncan, what's it like to be white?" And exactly. That was, I sort of stopped and thought, I don't know. I've never actually thought about it. And her point was, exactly. I mean, there's an aspect of privilege. You don't have to think about it. But it was an example of that sort of, you know, here's an aspect of my identity and experience that I haven't ever really thought about. I have to say that question led to quite a long conversation, and in some ways that, you know, it continues to be part of my work. But you could say the same thing about, you know, what's it like to be male, or, you know, what's it like to be whatever you are. So I think the challenge is what we need to do to be able to work effectively around the world is to, I guess, do two things. One is to recognize that we have the differences, but also to look for the commonalities and the similarities. And one of my colleagues, Bjørn Eklund in Norway, is an organizational psychologist who's doing some terrific work looking at ways people think and make decisions, which enables you to find commonalities with people, even if you're from very different cultural backgrounds. So it's both similarity and difference. It's very much in this field, it's a both and situation rather than an either or, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's a great example. And it's a very confronting question, isn't it? Because, like you said, in situations or in the privileged position of a white male in a white-dominated society, you probably have never thought about that deeply before. And yet, you know, the opposite question, what's it like to be black in this society, or what's it like to be a woman in this environment or this society, probably has occupied some part of your thinking at some point in time. So comes back to the point you were making earlier about, you know, if we are much more self-aware of our own culture, our own position, our own kind of privilege, if you like, then it gives us a much stronger point for considering our impact on the others and then looking at that similarity and differences. I think that's a really great point, because I think, to me, looking for the similarities, that's the place to start to get a connection with the other, if you want to call it that. And then and then the differences is the exciting stuff, really, for me, because if you're curious about, well, how do you do this, or how do you think about this, gives you a totally new perspective, which, you know, if we're just encapsulated in our own little world and our own little bubble, kind of lacks excitement for me.
Well, exactly. And yet I think, well, there are many things in what you just said. One is that sense, if we are in the majority group and we do have that automatic privilege, that doesn't make us bad people. And the fact that we have that privilege is okay.
But it does give us a responsibility, though. And I think that's where a lot of people perhaps take it too lightly. For example, we have a serious problem here in Australia with domestic violence, and I'm not sure what the number is at the moment, but it's horrendous how many women have been murdered by their partners through domestic violent incidents. And as a man, I think, you know, I have a responsibility there to do something to change that situation.
Yeah.
I mean, it's tough. I don't know what to do about it, but it's just an example of, I can't say, well, that's not my problem because I'm not a violent person. I don't mistreat my wife or my partner. Yeah. But I still, you know, being in that position of privilege, I still feel I have a sense of responsibility to do what I can to influence a change there.
Well, and that's very well expressed, and I very much agree with you. And I think it comes back for me to, in any of these areas, when we're looking at diversity in any aspect, if we're looking at culture, if we're in that majority group, the group that has more privilege and more power, there is that question of why would I want to wake up to this? And sometimes we wake up to it because we have to. We're confronted with something. But I think there is that. That's the question I start with when I'm working with my clients, when they say, well, you know, we value diversity and we want more diversity in our workplace. And our first question is why? And it's not an automatic response. I mean, I think people, there's the business case, which has been very well documented, that organizations with greater gender and cultural diversity perform better, but it's not automatic. You need to be able to work with it effectively. So some of my work I would describe as attempting to wake up the majority, but each person is going to have their own motivation for being conscious in the way that you just described of whatever the issue is.
It's a fascinating subject. So in terms of a company culture that supports diversity, how do you go about kind of structuring a culture like that or tackling a culture that maybe doesn't and as a result is a little bit toxic for some people?
Right.
I guess, you talked about starting with why do you want diversity? That's probably a really good place to start.
Mm. It is. And there needs to be more than the business case because the numbers themselves, while you can demonstrate it, it's not an instant sort of fix. It's like, oh, if we add more diversity, our numbers are going to go up immediately. It's really more of a longer term fix in a way. So there is the why, and then how do you create that inclusive culture? Well, there are multiple ways that you need to work on it. And one is to work in the leadership area to make sure that there is some very clear understanding in the leadership, and I'm talking leadership hierarchically here, which I use a broad definition of leadership. It can come from anywhere. But if we're looking at sort of the executive ranks of an organization, there needs to be some clear understanding and commitment to and accountability for an inclusive culture in that cohort of executives so that they really own it. One of the biggest mistakes organizations make is to say, oh, diversity and inclusion, that's something that human resources does. And that's a sure way to make sure that it's not going to happen. Mm. Honestly, with all due respect to the many human resources professionals out there who have responsibility for diversity, best thing you can do is to set it up as a separate structure, separate activity within the organization. So in the US, for example, in the UK, there's a function called Chief Diversity Officer, which is part of the C-suite, but not part of human resources, reporting directly to the CEO or managing director. So really seen as a separate kind of integral part of the functioning of the organization. So there's the leadership piece, there's the structural and governance piece. There is a certain amount of learning and education that needs to happen so people just understand the basic concepts. There's a whole measurement area. How do you track progress? What is it you're trying to measure? How do you know that you're being successful? One of the ways to do this is, and I'll put in a if I may, a, it's not really a plug. I'll just let people know that there is a project I'm involved with, which is a free resource called the Global Diversity and Inclusion Benchmarks. And there have been 95 people around the world, of which I'm one, who collaborate on looking at what works in terms of creating an inclusive culture. And we've now been doing this for over 10 years and are committed to making the resource freely available for organizations. And so there are many aspects of looking at how an inclusive culture works and how do you measure it and how do you know that you're moving in the direction that you want to move in. And it's interesting because sometimes, I'll just say sometimes people think, okay, well, we do diversity training, but, you know, that doesn't necessarily work. And I heard a great comment recently. It is, you know, is diversity training effective? And the comment was made, that's like asking, are restaurants good? Some of them are. Some of them aren't. Diversity training can be effective, but not by itself. So you need a really systemic approach to changing the culture of the organization. And for that, you need the leadership to be behind it.
Hmm. Yeah, that, you know, I had to laugh before when you said, oh, that's human resources function, because that just reminded me so much of my corporate days where, and it wasn't necessarily about diversity. There were so many things that were, oh, that's their function. And I thought, well, no, it's part of business. That's how we do business.
That's right.
Or it should be how we do business. Yeah, I had a fascinating conversation yesterday with Jonathan Grzybowski of Penji, who is a small business. And by the time this goes to air, that'll be probably the last episode. But one of the things he pointed out in terms of building the culture of their organization and their hiring thing was, you know, just having people there that do the right thing. And I think some aspect of this whole cultural diversity and respecting other cultures and working together better with people is kind of just doing the right thing.
Absolutely. And sometimes people say, oh, isn't this just good management or good leadership? Absolutely. That's what it is. And it's interesting that if we look at you know, the demographics, particularly of leadership in organizations in a lot of Western countries. So as an example, there is a very clear bias, positive bias towards men in leadership. And so if we have women as 50% of the workforce, are we so sure that women are not capable as leaders? And so this is then where the bias comes in, and the unconscious bias as to what does leadership look like and how is it expressed? And as you said before, you know, this is starting to change, and we still have a ways to go. I think the World Economic Forum looking at the gender gap in terms of politics, you know, political representation, education, health, and there's a fourth aspect to it. In terms of closing that gap between men and women, we're looking at currently globally at about 180 years before we get some kind of parity. Now, that's down from a little over 300 years about 20 years ago. So we're moving in the right direction, but still there are these inbuilt biases. So if we want to be effective in this area, we do need to understand that, yeah, it's just good management, but then these aspects of identity and diversity affect how we express that good management or good leadership.
Mm. Yeah, it's fascinating. And like you say, you know, 180 years is still a long time, even though the number has decreased recently. And the whole aspect is actually, the whole aspect of that gender equality is actually quite complex. And it's certainly in the public arena, very visible in politics pretty well across all the countries that I'm aware of.
It is increasingly visible, and yet it's interesting. There's still a lot of quite powerful biases in place. And you know, there's a lot of backlash because, you know, if you if you believe that the playing field has been level, then, which it hasn't, then when people are making attempts to level the playing field, if you've been on the sort of, you know, the group that's had more automatic privilege, let's say on the basis of gender, it's easy to feel as though you're losing something. Whereas the way I look at it is that actually if women are gaining, like we all gain. So for example, the whole idea of flexible work, work-life balance, which I'm not sure that such a thing exists, but now we talk more about flexibility. That really came out of looking for work-life balance for women who still had and still have the most of the childcare responsibilities and the unpaid work in the home. So how did we create situations where women could be in the workplace and have the ability to balance that with what they were doing at home? Well, gee, what's happened is now we talk more about flexibility, and it's not just women, but it's also men who are benefiting from a mindset that says, oh, it's possible to work flexibly. And I've got to believe that many of your listeners, particularly if they're involved in innovation technology, that you know, it's not 9 to 5, 5 days a week. And flexibility doesn't necessarily mean you work less or you work part-time. It's just how do you manage and how do you integrate your work and your life in a way that makes sense. Personally, I'm a single parent. And so for me, working flexibly was not an option. And yet, often there is the assumption that, oh, flexible work, that's more for women than it is for men. And, you know, men don't take up the option. So there's an area where a focus originally on women has actually benefited everybody. And I think that, that's very fabulous, much the case.
Yeah, that's a fabulous example. And I had Julia Streets on the podcast a little while ago, and she, one of her models of one of her businesses is having mothers who have childcare duties working from home through the internet. And she's got this whole workforce, and she says, you know, that there's essentially this untapped resource there of mothers who want to spend a large amount of their time with their children, looking after them at home, and want that flexibility that you talked about. But at the same time, they have incredible expertise and knowledge that remains untapped because they don't have that flexibility. And she set up a model in one of her businesses where you know, some of those people can work from home for her business. So that gives them that flexibility and gives her this resource that previously nobody had considered. And then the second thing, of course, as you said, once men then see, wow, this is a way I could work as well, and so I could spend more time with my kids.
Absolutely right. And I was just reading something recently about a digital marketing organization based in, I believe, in Melbourne, and I think it's called Versa, where they and it's run by a woman who decided that they would have Wednesday, every employee has Wednesday off. So they're essentially working Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday off, and then Thursday, Friday. And what they're finding is actually an increase in productivity. People are being paid for 5 days. They're working, you know, effectively four, but people get that, you know, you kind of starting the week with a certain level of energy on Monday, and people tend to be more productive at the beginning of the week. Basically, they're getting the beginning of the week twice during the week. And so people's productivity is up. And, you know, it's true, you have to manage some of the things around, you know, if you're having to deliver something for a client on a Wednesday. So there's flexibility there, but that's the fundamental structure that they're using. And apparently it's been quite effective. So, you know, if we kind of innovate our thinking around what does flexibility even mean and who benefits, it really can be quite powerful.
Yeah, that's a great example too. All right. Well, I think that's a good segue into our innovation round, The Buzz, which is designed to help our audience who are primarily innovators and leaders in their field with some tips from your experience. So I've got five questions, and hopefully you'll give us some really insightful answers that'll inspire people to go and do something awesome today.
Okay, terrific.
So what's the number one thing you think anyone needs to do to be more innovative?
So three questions. Why are we doing this? Who is it for and who's going to be impacted? And how are we going to do it? And then within that, I think just to, you know, to be clear about what it is that we're trying to do. There's a sense sometimes that innovation is good, is automatically good. And I think we need to step back and sort of think, okay, let's use a little bit of critical thinking here about this idea. Mm. I might be excited about it, but why are we doing it? Who's it going to affect and how?
Yeah. Yeah. That why question is so powerful, isn't it? And you're right. Often we just say, oh, that's innovative, so it must be good. But, sort of a corollary to that is we think it has to be a huge change from current state, which isn't necessarily true either.
You know, I agree with that. And the other thing I would say about being innovative is to, it might seem counterintuitive, but to be grounded, to be very kind of solid and very clear about what it is that you're doing and where you're coming from. So, you know, in my work, in a way, the innovation, which was these five foundations of diversity, was to go back to, because I was looking at lots of new stuff coming out in the field, and I thought, hang on a minute, what are the things that you absolutely need to be thinking about that will work across cultures, across countries, across sectors? What are the fundamental questions you need to ask? And that required really going back and being more grounded in those questions of why are we doing this and who's impacted and how do we do it? So I think being very grounded, we can get all excited about new ideas, but yeah. keeping our feet on the ground is important.
Yeah. All right. That's great. What's the best thing you've done to develop new ideas?
Two things. One is just to allow them to appear rather than forcing them. I found that the best ideas I've come up with have not been when I was looking for them. In fact, many times in my life, I've found that the idea that I was looking for or the thing that I was looking for, whatever it was, only appeared when I stopped looking for it. Again, counterintuitive, but sometimes the more I've pushed for an answer, the farther away it's been. But the other thing I would say is to be persistent in finding different ways to realize your idea. So, for example, I mentioned I came out with a book last year. I'd been trying for about 5 years to get a book written, and it just wasn't happening. I tried taking myself away to Tasmania to, you know, lock myself up and try writing, and that didn't work. I got dictation software, and then I, you know, got 60,000 words, but then I had to edit it all, and that didn't work. And finally, I invited a colleague to interview me, and I recorded the interview, and that conversation turned into the book. So it was just continuing to look for different ways that were not necessarily obvious to me. But the reason that I came up with that conversation idea is that I came across a book in a completely different field that was a conversation between two people. And I thought, oh, I really like this. Oh, I wonder if I could do that. So the persistence in being open to different ways of doing things and then just allowing that to appear, give yourself the space.
Hmm. Yeah, that's a couple of great suggestions there, particularly having that space, because often that kind of bubbles something up from the unconscious that's been processing stuff, like you mentioned very early on in the interview, that, you know, 90% of what we're doing is actually unconscious, and some of the working through problems or working through issues that we need to deal with often happens there as well. And if we allow ourselves space, then that bubbles up. And I love the idea about interviews to come up with the book, or particularly, you know, chunking that up, exploring different options if you're stuck.
And, you know, interestingly enough, that interview, I wasn't necessarily assuming that was going to turn into a book, but I thought, oh, here's someone who's going to spur my thinking and ask questions. I deliberately got someone who was very different to me, and sure enough, she got me thinking about things in a different way. And I thought, oh, let's write this down. So we did.
All right, that's great. I love it. What's one resource you use most often?
Is this about sort of a resource for innovation or productivity?
Yeah, for innovation or productivity. Something that helps you in what you do.
I'm going to go counterintuitive again, and the thing that helps me the most is there are three things actually. One is meditation. I use a mindfulness practice. The other is getting out into nature and getting completely away from whatever it is that I'm thinking about, and just getting absorbed in being in the natural world and just taking that in. And the third is exercise, physical exercise. So those three in combination, I know, are going to put me into a receptive space where I'm going to be able to be more productive and follow through on ideas. And again, it's counterintuitive because it almost seems like I'm getting away from thinking about new things, but that's what enables the innovation to come up in my experience.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I have had a lot of guests talk about meditation and getting out into a different environment, and also exercise. And I know certainly, I mean, I'm not into meditation as such, but getting out into nature and exercise, that certainly is big for me. And it, I find that that's where I get a lot of my ideas.
It's interesting. Yeah, I mean, the meditation piece, I think more and more people are becoming interested in it, not as a spiritual practice necessarily, but as a way of simply quieting the mind, but also noticing what it is that you're thinking, because our minds tend to be pretty busy most of the time, and to stop and just notice, oh, there's a thought, and it could be a useful one. So.
All right. What's the best way to keep a project on track?
I think it's important to know how you work and how your client works, and to accept your natural style of working. Push yourself to some extent when you need to, but I find that I'm more productive when I understand that. So, for example, some of your listeners may be familiar with the Myers-Briggs type indicator. In that system, I would be described as someone who is pressure prompted. So I like to get things done, but I tend to let a certain amount of pressure build, like a deadline is looming, like, oh, I have to prepare the questions for this podcast. Hey, that's tomorrow. I'd better do that. I actually know that I work more effectively and in a more focused way when I have a certain level of pressure that's built up. And so I've become a lot more accepting I know that podcast is coming. I need to prepare for that. But, oh, it's a few days away. And so I just kind of let it go and not worry about it, knowing that the pressure will, in the right time, I will get prepared. Now, a number of my clients work in very different ways. So it's really understanding how you work, how they work, accepting both of those and being able to make the appropriate adjustments.
Yeah, that's a great tip. And I like the idea of, it comes back to this self-awareness thing, doesn't it? Which is kind of a message that's been coming through the cultural discussion we've had.
Yeah, that's definitely a bias that I have. It's around self-awareness and developing your own competence as an individual. You know, it's like if you want to change the world, you need to change yourself. So you got to know who you are. So, yeah.
Because that's what you're in control of. Okay, what's the number one thing anyone can do to differentiate themselves?
Well, it kind of connects to the last piece of that we were just talking about. And to me, that is to be authentic and to be yourself. So early on, a number of years ago, when I was facilitating programs, I was working with a co-facilitator, And I was fairly new at working with groups at that point. And I'm up in front of a group of 30 people. We've got 3 days together, and I'm presenting in a relatively formal way. And my co-presenter, who had a lot more experience, said to me, and she was watching me, watching the group, very skilled at this. And she said, "You know, Duncan, the group responds to you a lot better when you're just yourself. Just be who you are." Now, it took me a while to actually be able to do that, to step out of the role of presenter and just be with the group in an authentic way. But I think people respond well to that. I've seen so many people who do presenting or public speaking, and it's, you know, it's very stiff, it's very formal, they're clearly reading from a script. And if they just step away from that and are just themselves and just kind of like, well, this is who I am, you know, people relate to a lot better. That could be in public speaking. It could be in leading a team within an organization, leading a design team, just to allow yourself to not play a particular role, like this is what a team leader is. Just be yourself, be clear about what it is you're trying to achieve, and then just be authentic. And I think that's, for all of us, that we're all unique individuals, and we bring our full selves to work, and I think everybody benefits, especially ourselves.
Well, that's a great example of being yourself and how it actually impacts on the relationship you have with other people. All right. Well, thanks for getting us through the buzz. This has been really great, Duncan. I've really enjoyed this conversation. I could keep going on and digging into this topic more and more. As I've said a few times throughout it, it's quite a complex topic and a big topic. So where can people reach out and find out more about you, find out about your book, and also even say thank you for what you shared today?
So people are welcome to go onto my website, which is www.adc-assoc.com. So it's ADC Associates, so adc-assoc.com. People are welcome to email me at dsmith@adc-assoc.com. I'm on LinkedIn as well, Duncan Smith, ADC Associates. People will be able to find me there. So if people have questions, they're very welcome to follow up.
All right, great. And we'll have links to those in the show notes so people can click through. Now, what's the number one piece of advice you'd give to any business owner who wants to be a leader in their field and in innovation?
I would say to be true to your own values, to know what it is that you're wanting to achieve in the world, and stay true to that, and not to be too swayed or too distracted by trends that seem exciting at the time, but just to stay grounded and clear about what it is that you're trying to do. So again, a little bit counterintuitive, but I think we make more progress in the future when we keep grounded in the present.
Yeah, and I think I've said this before on this podcast quite often, that the power of focus is actually very strong. So being true to the values and being focused on what you're trying to achieve then really gives you that.
All right. Look, it's taken me a while to come up with, you know, working in this field for a while. It's like, what is it that I'm actually trying to do? And that idea of helping people to work together better. It took a while, but and it seems simple, but it's really helpful to have something that's quite clear, that's values driven, that you can come back to and say, "This is what I'm on about," and that definitely helps you keep going.
Yeah, and of course, there's fine tuning of that all the time, isn't there? In terms of, you know, you talked about don't jump to new things all the time, but there are new ways and new possibilities of achieving what you're setting out to achieve. So
absolutely,
we talked about that early on in the innovation round. All right, finally then, Duncan, who would you like me to interview on a future InnovaBuzz podcast and why?
Wow, Wow. You know, that's the place in the preparation for this where I drew a little bit of a blank. So I'm going to need to come back to you on that one. Think about it. I maybe get some ideas from you as to what would be most useful for your listeners, because I have a wide ranging network around the world. And so maybe you and I can have a bit more of a conversation about what would be most valuable for your listeners. And I'll narrow down my long list of possible names to one or two that would be most useful to you, I think.
Excellent. Okay, we'll have that conversation later on. So thanks so much for sharing your time and your insights with us on the Innova Buzz podcast today. I've really enjoyed this. It's been a great conversation. I've learned quite a bit. There's a lot of challenging aspects to cultural diversity and dealing with that in a way that benefits everyone. But I think it's a hugely important topic. So thanks for spending time with me talking about it today. I wish you all the best for the future, and let's keep in touch.
Thanks very much, Jürgen. It's been great to be with you.
I hope you enjoyed that insightful and thought-provoking conversation with Duncan and took something with you from what he shared. This was another reminder for me about the importance of knowing yourself first, and for change, work on yourself first. So make your change on yourself first, in this case, to help people work together better through embracing diversity. I'd love to know what you took away from Duncan's interview. Leave a comment below the blog post, which you can find at innovabiz.co/Duncan Smith. That is DUNCANSMITH. Or lowercase, or one word, innovabiz.co/Duncan Smith. You'll also find contact information for getting in touch with Duncan there, as well as links to the ADC website, to Duncan's audio series, his videos, and his books, Foundations of Diversity. Duncan suggested we interview Beck Lloyd of Rowboat on a future InnovaBuzz podcast. So Beck, keep an eye on your inbox for an invitation from us to the InnovaBuzz podcast, courtesy of Duncan Smith. Finally, I'd like to give a shout out to the Investor Boy from the USA for his review of the InnovaBuzz podcast. He says, "Incredible guest and great host. Love, love, love what they've been doing." Yes, he did use the word love 3 times. "I've been listening for a couple of episodes and I'm hooked." Thank you, Investor Boy. I really appreciate that. And I'm glad you enjoyed those episodes. I hope that other episodes you've listened to in the meantime, that the guests have also provided you with great value. I'm sure they have. Remember to visit innovabiz.co/VIP to access the Transformational Marketing Hub and all its free and exceptionally useful information to help you transform your marketing. Also, check out our Tales of Marketing Transformation show at talesofmarketingtransformation.com, where each episode will provide one valuable message to guide you on your journey of marketing transformation. And of course, tune in again next week. We've got some more fantastic guests lined up, including Leanne Hughes of First Time Facilitator and Deb Farnworth Wood, the founder of Australian Skin Clinics. Stay connected. Subscribe to the InnovaBuzz podcast so you'll make sure you'll never miss another episode. Head on over to innovabiz.co/subscribe. We'd also love you to leave us a review, because what you think matters to us. Take some of the ideas you've heard today and apply them in your business. Any thoughts, ideas, suggestions, or questions, then share them in the comments below the blog post. And remember, if you want to get better marketing results than you ever have, join our fantastic Facebook community at the Tales of Marketing Transformation Facebook group. All you have to do is go to innovabiz.co www.ipsos.org/TMA. It's free to join. I hope to see you there soon. Until next time, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Remember to be awesome and keep innovating.